channels is today. They tell us that the average person is now bombarded with about 1,400 messages every day. And the worst part is that of those 1,400, most of us, or the average person anyway, would like to act, would like to behave on about 400. Now, how could you possibly get that many messages and behave on 400 of them in any given day? So if you have an audience, a public, that's being bombarded with 400 messages they want to do something about, it certainly seems to me to reinforce the idea that we need to follow this dictum, that fewer messages equals more communication and far more persuasion. And yet, look at your own material when you get home and see how many things you asked your publics to do in the last year alone. Well, the fusion process has a flip side, and I think that the flip side of the fusion process is at least as important as the process itself, because it was really the beginning of all of our work on audience segmentation. If you take this process and apply it to large numbers of people, you can ask yourself legitimately, well, how do those people respond? Do they all respond the same to that process? And what the scholars found was that no, they do not. That in fact, the basic variable is the time that it takes people to go through the process, to adopt a new idea, new product or whatever. And they divide these time variables into a set of five. The first group are called the innovators. Rogers now says that maybe as many as 2.5% of any given public will be innovators. Innovators are people who really, the key to all of this is the social trial phase, because innovators are people who don't need a lot of reinforcement from opinion leaders and their peers. They're the kind that want to crash through and do something when they first hear about it. The trouble is, for public relations purposes, that if you think about the motivation of those people, why do people want to be first always? Usually because they're ego-driven. You know, I'm going to be first in my neighborhood. So they're a very difficult public to work with. Furthermore, by the time we get to them with our idea, they're off innovating on something else. So that makes them doubly hard to work with. Once the innovators have done something with a product or an idea, then along comes a group called the early adopters. The early adopters are a somewhat larger group. You can get a lot of numbers on how large they are. I don't think it's important, because obviously they'll be different than any public we're working with at any given time. The thing about the early adopters is that they need only a little social reinforcement. Somebody else has to do it first, so that really, if you examine their psychological motivation, it's fear of embarrassment. They don't care, you see, if they're seen driving this unpopular vehicle, because if somebody chides them on it, they'll say, well, Joe had one first. As long as Joe had one first, Joe the innovator, then it's okay. Therefore, interestingly, in this group are many of the movers and shakers in our society at all socioeconomic levels. Think, for example, of our official leaders, elected folks, corporate and organizational CEOs and others. Isn't the number one thing they're worried about being embarrassed? They don't want to be caught out. They want to be in sync always. Furthermore, the new ideas, but they don't want to pioneer them. Because pioneering doesn't pay off. But being early does pay off. So if you look at this from that point of view, you can test the correctness of this theory. The next group is called the early majority. And the fourth group is called the majority. And those two, in a sense, can almost be considered together, even though there is a time lag for the majority. Often, this will amount to as much as 80% of a public. And these are truly Dickie Nixon's old tried and true silent majority. This is Joe and Jane six-pack, and Joe and Jane have a cool Coors beer in this hand, and the channel flipper in this hand, and they know what their lives are all about. Please do not bug them. Not 400 messages, not 4 messages, just leave them alone. The social scientists, the political scientists tell us that you can stir them to real corporate action about once a decade. Well, test the political scientist theory. Watergate, for some reason, really got them riled up. There was this huge action None of the elections since have, less than half of the eligible voters have voted every time since. The fact that we now possess weapons that could easily destroy Earth this afternoon doesn't seem to faze them. It hasn't quite gotten to them. I don't know what it'll be this decade. Maybe it'll be that. Maybe it'll be some other issue. Human nature being what it is, it'll probably be some scandal like Watergate. They're far more exciting. You're spending your time with the Coors and the Channel Flipper, you know, it's more in sync to go for a scandal than it is to go for a serious issue. And so if you just think about that for a minute, it starts to explain the sociology of our society. Now, there's another thing about this. If you aren't familiar at all with VALS or any of the psychographic measures, I assume most of you are familiar with VALS. It stands for Values, Attitudes, and Lifestyles. It's that wonderful study. One of its original sponsors is with us here today, which tries to give us a sociological and psychological picture of the American public. The interesting thing is, if you apply this to VALS, it's a very, very, very close. There is a fifth group, and I want to tell you about those because these are very useful for public relations practitioners. They're called laggards. They're the last ones to make the decision. Now, there are two kinds of laggards, is the only thing wrong. The first kind of laggard are true laggards, people who really just are very slow to get to it. Some of you have heard me tell about the farmer who lives next to me at my blueberry farm in New Hampshire. He's a dairy farmer, and 2 years ago, he literally got around to buying a milking machine because he was pretty sure they were here to stay. The worst part is he went up and took the bunny out of a cigar box under his bed because he's still not sure about things. I kind of agree with him there, but that's not the point. He's a true laggard. Then there's the other kind of laggard, which sort of my whole state of New Hampshire represents. You know, in New Hampshire, we live in these lovely little villages set in God's country amid the mountains and with the ocean nearby and all these lovely rushing streams. And every town has a village green, you know, with all those beautiful white houses and a church with a tall white steeple. You all know that picture. And in addition, we have no sales tax, no income tax, no corruption in government. And so other states are always sending delegations up to find out, how did you get so far ahead? And our answer is simple. It's easy. We never changed since 1784. Now, there are some key laggards, people who are beyond this whole damn process. They know their values. They're hanging with them. And they can be called upon. For example, in our work now with public education, those are the people that we're willing to spend lots of money to find through research. Because they still believe that Jane can learn to read and Johnny can learn to add and that public schools are important to democracy. They haven't been swept along with all these new fads. A few years ago, when it was still possible to make some interest on your money and the money market certificates came along, remember that? Banks were paying 6%, thrift institutions were paying a little more, and you could make 12 or 13% by sending your money off to one of the money markets. We were retained in New England. We have a group of banks called savings banks. And they're not full commercial banks. They're more like savings and loans or thrift institutions. And they were afraid they were going to go right out of business. And so they asked us, could we find any way that they could survive? We did, in fact, find a way. We went and found the laggards. And here's what our studies found. Contrary to opinion, you see, in diffusion theory, of course, is what led us to this. We actually applied diffusion theory. Public opinion would be, oh my gosh, they're paying 12% at the money markets. Everybody is going to send their money off. And see, the assumptions there are ridiculous and not at all in accord with process management or what we know about the science of public relations or about human nature. That implies everybody knows they're paying 12%. Believe you me, friends, half the public had no idea of that in our study. Half the public, after years, a couple of years of these high interest rates, half the people didn't even know that. They're busy. They got a Coors in this one, remember? And a Channel Flipper in this one. Of those who did know, 40% still weren't going to send it off to the money markets. Why? Well, first of all, I walked downtown, and there it is. It's on the corner. It's marble. I can pat it and feel the warmth of that marble. Boy, that's my bank. And I walk along and I look in the big plate glass window, and there it is in the back. That's the vault. My money's right in there. It's right in there. Safe. Furthermore, you know, here's Tom, the local bank president, standing there. Now, does he look like a guy who would hit the till, you know, pick up a blonde and go to Montreal? No way. But if I send my money off to Boston, to Fidelity, you see, part of Philadelphia, of all places, to Dreyfus. I don't know those people. I don't know what they might do with my money. And when I need it, I might not be able to get it. And that's exactly, phrased a little differently, of course, but that's exactly what our research discovered. And so instead of competing with those high interest rates, which they couldn't do anyway, when the thrift started playing to this deeper-seated fear of safety, our thrift sailed through that period, not only cut their losses, but started rising back up. All because we happened to know that there was a group out there called laggards. And we found the positive laggards, the ones who still believed in safety in banks, and we plugged them in. Well, if there's any theory that is important for us to know, I believe it's the fusion process. If you're not familiar with this, buy Everett Rogers' book. If you want a nice two-page summary of one of the most famous diffusion process studies, give me your business card and just write diffusion on it, and I will send you a copy of that study. Incidentally, you should know, this particular study was introduced at the 1969 PRSA conference. So once again, these scholars have been out there working for us if only we will watch what they're doing. And I mean that in two ways, but we'll talk about that later. I want to talk about some more specific things because I think that I hope I've given you some kind of a view of this theory. I want to talk now about some of the implications of this theory. It seems to me the implications of all of this are clear. They do revolve around human nature. But if communications floating out there do not motivate people, the people are more apt to be fully able to behave after they have checked any information they've gotten through communications with peer groups. And it seems to me the next thing we have to take a look at is that wonderful word, facts. Because I think a lot of us believe that facts are powerful. And I would suggest to you that facts are almost powerless, at least in the initial phases of the persuasion process. And the reason that they are powerless are numerous. But one of the reasons is, what is a fact? And what is a fact? It's very hard to tell. It's like, what is truth? You see, what is a fact? If facts are so easy, why does it take a jury of 12 people and high-priced lawyers on both sides to arrive at them in a court case? It's obvious that we can all argue over what the facts are in anything. And so therefore, if we're going to communicate facts, we're in deep trouble. Furthermore, if people were motivated by facts, they would be those lofty, rational individuals I talked about, rather than the real human beings that are down here. Because we do not make our decisions factually. Just take a look at the diffusion process. You see, we might get a lot of nice facts in up here, but as soon as we get down here, facts give way to something else. In fact, they really give way to it right here, and that something else is perception. For some of my clients, I believe in the positive power of semantics, and so therefore I try to have wonderful semantic phrases which sound like what I'm offering is different than somebody else. You know, product differentiation, that's how you raise your prices, right? Well, Jane, don't you listen to this. I see a couple of clients in the audience. Shut your ears. We're starting to call what we do perception management. If we can do anything for a client, it's to help them manage the perceptions that various publics have of them. Now, obviously, that means a lot of research to determine what those perceptions are, but it also means some techniques for knowing when there are misperceptions out there and when there are perceptions. And notice that this is totally different than fact. This is totally different than fact. Perception is the most powerful force in the human society. There isn't anything else that's even close to perception, because what perception is what Mother Nature gave us all to enable us to interact with our world. Perception is a sort of a screen or a wall that stands right here in front of us and really all around us and makes it possible for us to interpret and to defend ourselves against that world that's around us. And what perception consists of, yes, there are some facts, some logic in the brain that's involved, maybe 10 to 15% according to some scholars, but there's an awful lot more emotion in our hearts and intuition in our guts. That all goes into our perception. And then, of course, there's our experience, both our real experience and our vicarious experience, something we saw in a movie or read in a book. And then, of course, there are our opinion leaders, our peers, and what they have gotten into us, plus our six senses. And all of those, somehow, if there is a miracle of human life, I think this has to be it, in 30 milliseconds, 30 milliseconds, the IBMs that we are give us a perception on any subject, even if we have never met that subject before. Take a human person, blindfold that person, take them to Mars, and when you take the blindfold off, bingo, they will have a whole set of perceptions about Mars. Will they be factual? Very doubtful. But they'll have them for two reasons. One, we need them to protect ourselves to be able to function in the environment. And secondly, how else could we make any sense of it? Interesting though, very interesting fact, that our perceptions are theories. That's all they are. They're theories about what's happening around us. That's why I, as a practitioner, think theories are so important. When we form these perceptions, as I say, they may be accurate, they may be inaccurate, but there's one thing we can be fairly sure of. They will rarely, if ever, be factual. They certainly will hardly ever be totally factual. Therefore, in order for us to persuade people at all, we have to get away from this and over to learning more about this. What are people's perceptions apt to be of any given policy, product, service, person? And how can we work within their realm of perception? Now, there's one thing that immediately becomes obvious. You cannot practice public relations today without a hell of a lot of research. Scott Cutliffe, if you don't believe me, you can ask him, he's here at the conference. And Scott finally retired as dean at Georgia. You Georgia graduates, I didn't mean anything by the word finally. I just mean finally did. Nothing implied there at all. And Scott retired as dean. I asked him for our newsletter. I said, Scott, you know, sum it all up. We've been in it all this time, talked to all those people. What is the state of the field today? Interestingly enough, he came back, as Howard Chase had, and started talking about the process management of the field. And he made this particular point. He said that in public relations, we still believe that we can shoot our arrows into the air to land we know not where. Meaning our programs, our messages, we shoot them up there, gang. We have no means of predicting where they're going to come down because we don't do the research first. And so therefore, we're just shooting arrows into the air at all times. Well, maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong. I've heard all the arguments. We haven't got the budget. I haven't got the time. I sure hope your accountants have either the budget or the time. And when I go to my doctor, by God, I want him to have both. Because I don't want either of those persons shooting any arrows into the air and not having some idea where they're going to come down. To deal with perceptions, you've got to do the research. Then we have some sense. Then we have to start doing something that's very difficult for us. We have to start applying real human nature. And the essence of real human nature along decision-making lines, because remember, we want people to behave, and that means they've got to decide to do so. The essence of human behavior along decision-making lines might be described as something like illogical decision-making. That's what we need to become practitioners of. We need to understand how and why people make illogical decisions. Because people do make illogical decisions. And yet organization after organization works otherwise. When you have an issue in your outfit, what does the boss say? Get the facts out there, right? Just get the facts out there. Bullet theory, facts, everybody will jump and say, oh my God, Tom, I didn't realize how we had maligned your wonderful institution. What they're really saying is that jerk. Know any better. The case studies on that are just too voluminous to go into. So let's talk a little bit about illogical decision making. In most organizations, decisions are made by what is considered a logical procedure. In fact, one of the problems that we in public relations face is that we start educating our children the minute they get to school, in most cases even younger, that logic is a wonderful thing. And I'm not suggesting that it isn't, and that someday we might not all become angels and be logical. I'm only suggesting that most of us aren't. We are all, as Mike said, sinners. But yet, when a youngster does something foolish, what do we say? That's not logical. Stop that. That's not logical. Don't think that way. And when we get them into school, we start training them for logic, and then all of a sudden they graduate into the real world. And now they start acting like all the rest of us, and they make illogical decisions. So unless we know if they're going to make illogical decisions, we're in trouble. I see a lot of skepticism out there. You don't like this idea of the logical decisions. It's counter to everything you've always been taught, right? All right. Let me prove it to you. If logical decisions are such hot stuff, then obviously all of us conduct our lives according to logic, right? We don't follow the fusion process. Why, when we want to lose weight, as I did recently and still have to do some more, we buy a diet book and we read it, it's all logical, and we just follow it automatically, bingo, right, and we lose weight, correct? What a damn lie. We go to Weight Watchers. And somebody says, you lost 2 pounds, wow, hooray, you did it. And we go back every week to get reinforced. Now, if we were such logicians, obviously we could follow the logic of this, we wouldn't need all that. But let's take it a step further even. What's the most important decision that humans make in their lives? Well, probably, I guess if you do it in terms of time spent, it has to be a choice of a mate. But today you have to say choice of mates, it's sort of a serial thing. Choosing, we'll call it choosing a mate to be grammatically correct and leave those other moral judgments out. Choosing a mate, because, you know, if you just figure up the time, we spend more time with those folks than with anybody else in our lives. We have families together and make big investments together and cars and houses and that. So that's probably the most important decision we'll ever make. How many of you here have made that decision? How many of you here are married? Don't be shy, it's all right. Or have what they call a special friend. Both, anybody? Both? How about that, Eli? Good for you. One honest person in the group. You better become an accountant. We don't have an accountant. Now, how many of you could tell me honestly that you made this decision, you made a special friend or both? Logic. How many of you made that decision logic? It's the most important decision a human in our society will ever make. Isn't that interesting, you see? This really important decision, we didn't make that logically, did we? No, we wanted to plug in our emotions, our intuition, we wanted to know what our mothers thought. Well, you better, by going. All of those things. We didn't make that logic. Take it a step further. Compare it with organizational logic. You get married, you have a family, the kids grow up, they get to be 3, 4, 5, what do? Call them in and have sort of a job review? Is that what you do? A performance review? Well, Johnny, baby, you know, I don't know. You don't keep your room very clean, and gee whiz, you're not eating all the things Mother tells you to, and therefore, since you don't shape up, out you go. Out of the family. You can't hang around. You don't make it. I mean, stupid. We wouldn't even think of that. It's an illogical decision. We keep all those kids. Okay? I can see some of you, it was a very take even a more mundane subject, the subject of buying a house. That's a very important decision for most of us, because today it takes most all the loot we're ever apt to have and be able to amass. You know, logic plays almost no part in the purchase of a house, according to studies done by the National Association of Realtors. People think it does. And if I went back there and chose one of you and said, why did you buy your house? I know, guess what you'd say? You'd say, well, it had a lot of closet space. Or it had this big basement right in the store. Or the kitchen was wonderful. You know, the stove is right here. And then just 3 feet away is the sink. And right over here is the refrigerator. It's a perfect workspace. You'd give me all those logical answers, only reflecting, you see, this early training of ours that we should be logical. We should not be sinners. Now, how do people really buy houses? Here's how they buy them. The realtors call it curb appeal. Curb appeal. You'll even see it often in ads for houses. This house has a lot of curb appeal. Well, it's just slipped over. You see, they're foolishly giving away their secret in their ads. Here's what curb appeal is. You go to the realtor's office, you hop in the car, and all, you know, they always want to drive you over because they want a captive audience. They don't want you following along. You might pass some other realtor's sign on the way and stop off. Good thinking. But all the way over here, notice it's jabber, 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 jabber. They talk a blue streak until you get about a half a block from the house, and then suddenly silence descends. And a well-trained real estate salesperson, just all that time, is watching you, just watching you. Because as the car pulls up in front of the house, that's what they want to know. Does this house have curb appeal? In other words, your first perception, your first theory about that house. And if you kind of light up, wow, let's go right in. You kind of go, oh. They say, you know, I got a better one in the south end. Let's just keep right on going. And the reason they do that is because their figures show that 90%+ of the houses that do not have curb appeal on first sight do not sell to that buyer. Totally perceptive. Even when you get them inside, if they have all those wonderful features, and they've done some pretty serious studies, and you take them inside and they say, and then they say, wow, you know, that house is a lot better than I thought at first. And they turn around and come up and say, oh, and they go buy something else. Because curb appeal is terribly important. So even in the purchase of a house, we, in fact, make illogical decisions. So the question for us then as practitioners is, knowing these theories, knowing this well-documented science, how can we apply this to our practices? I think there are a number of ways that we can apply this. And let me just very quickly share with you some of the ways that we can apply it. And I will also, in doing this, give you some extrapolations from the behavioral science. There are four primary rules that I personally have gleaned from the behavioral sciences that apply to us immediately. The first rule comes from sociology, and it's the rule of abuse. The sociologists tell us their theory is any change in the relationship between two groups is a result of an abuse on the part of one. Any change in a relationship is a result of an abuse. Now, this abuse may be real, it may be only perceived and undocumentable, you couldn't prove it in court, and it may only be feared. A lot of the abuses with employee publics, as we know, is that they fear the shop is going to close, their pay is going to be cut, they're going to lose their job. Those are felt, perceived, if you will, by humans as abuses. And so therefore, practitioners need to know that until we can discover and solve people's feelings of abuse, all the rest of our activity is basically meaningless. Because when people are looking at your organization through the screen of an abuse, your ability to persuade them is almost nil. Almost nil. You have to get around the abuse, you have to get over the abuse, you have to admit the abuse, be sorry for it. How many of you have ever had a strike in your organization? Well, if you ever have, how did you conduct yourself for the first month, first 2-3 weeks after the strike? I'll bet it was a lot different. I'll bet you really were working on those folks to say, hey, I know you feel abused, gang. Listen, it's okay, you're sorry, or whatever you said. You probably didn't say you're sorry. American managers are still terribly bad at using those marvelously persuasive words. You gotta take care of the abuses first. For our clients, we make what we call abuse lists. What are all the real abuses? What are abuses that we, through research, can document are perceived by them? And what abuses do they fear? And we just assiduously either avoid those topics, or we take them head on and get people together, get them solved and out, because nothing else can happen until we get that out of the way. Basic human nature. The next rule comes from psychology, is the rule of participation. The psychological theorem is people will only get behind those policies or actions that they have had a voice in making. Only those policies or actions that they have had a voice in making. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to run every organization by participatory democracy. Remember, Joe and Jane still have the Coors in one hand and the flipper in the other. But you better jolly well make sure they perceive that they were involved, which often only means giving them the opportunity to be involved. And as for the makers and shakers, we better be darn sure they really are involved or really had an opportunity. Because until they participate, they are not going to get behind the policy. Now, American organizations don't run that way. Remember, I keep talking about organizations because I think that our job here, basically what we do is to make organizations effective. That's what we do. American organizations don't run that way generally. We are still working on the old dictatorial model. You will do this, and you will do it because I said so and for the following reasons. A study was done not long ago by a group that called themselves the Quaker Management Group. They merely applied the 350-year-old principles of Quaker meeting to the workplace. And what they found was this, that in a typical hierarchical organization where decisions are mandated from the top, and they're done because we always say we don't have enough time for participation. But this is what happens. For the first year, People say, I can't believe it. Even those turkeys couldn't really mean this. Gotta be a mistake. For the second year, they say, gosh, you know, maybe they're serious. It's been a year now. Maybe they do mean it. But they still then, for that year, do everything they can to find how can I get around this decision because it looks serious. And the third year, they spend sort of reluctantly knuckling under. So it takes, in the fourth year, before the decision really grabs hold, according to the study, on the average. On the other hand, in participatory process, they found it took 12 to 18 months to get the big decisions made, a long time. But 6 months later, the organization was functional on that new decision. So in fact, participation turned out to be almost twice as time effective as dictatorial decisions. And we should know that, because here it is, not only working in internal publics, but also with external publics. The next group, the next theory, also comes from psychology. It's the rule of rewards. We already know all about the rule of rewards internally. If we can't pay them in money, we pay them in gold braid, we pay them in praise, we pay them in something else. But I have to ask very often myself, what reward am I offering this external public that I want to behave in a way that will help my organization? What's in it for them? The basic principle of what's in it for them. Sometimes I think we lose sight of that with our external audiences, although I think most of us are pretty good at it internally. Finally, there's a principle from anthropology. It's the principle of the cheerleader. The principle of the cheerleader, according to the anthropologists, is that there has never been a successful society that did not have at its core a person that we would call a cheerleader. It may have been a high priest, it may have been just a respected citizen or two, it may have been a shaman, the chief, anybody. But somebody whose essential role it is to keep saying, we can do it, we're good and getting better, or we made a mistake and we can overcome it, or whatever cheerleading is necessary. And all that stuff we watch in the football games is very much in sync with everything we know from the behavioral sciences. Well, those are just four things that I can tell you. There's one other thing I can share with you. By the way, have you got a list of your own of what public relations can do? I mean, if your boss called you in tomorrow and said, hey, Susie, you know, this public relations you're always talking about, what can it do for my organization? Can you rattle off a list that you can prove on the bottom line it will do? Well, you're in deep trouble, aren't you? Well, I mean, they want us to give behaviors. What in hell is the answer? If you'd like a starter list of eight ways that various organizations have been able to prove with their accountants that they can affect the bottom line, write eight ways on your business card and I'll send you a list. I'm not going to go into that now. Part of the process, but don't necessarily send for my list. I mean, send for my list, I'm glad to send it to you. But make your own list. What can public relations do to affect the bottom line of your organization, to make your organization more effective through stimulating behaviors of the people who make up the organization and who make up the world in which it operates. I should tell you, by the way, that the way I came up with my list was just the way I gave it to you. I was sitting there in a board meeting and some smart director from out of state, you know, looked down the table at me and said, okay, Jackson, what can PR do for this outfit? Being a consultant friend, you know what I did. I marked to the board and I showed him eight ways, or no, I think it was four, that was all I could think of. So, and then you know what else I did. I applied science. I observed, I studied, and now I have a list of eight ways that we have been able to determine some organizations have proven on, as I say, through accounting principles, the organization either made money or saved money. Bottom line dollar effect through the application of public relations. I think we should be armed with that. All I want to talk about now is two quick things, and then I'll let you go. We should, in the process management, in doing these things and applying these principles, we need to know the kinds of campaigns, if you will, in which we apply them. I can identify six kinds of campaigns. Now, I'm not offering this as the ultimate list. I'm only saying this is what I can identify at the moment. First of all, we know that we can do an awareness campaign. You know, it's September, school has started. Do not run over kindergartners at the crosswalk. Simple awareness. That's all we need to get out, because people know better and they just need to be reminded it's September. Sometimes that isn't enough and we have to do an information campaign. An information campaign goes beyond the simple awareness and gives some emotional reason, possibly some data, some factual reasoning to follow up the emotional reasoning of why people should do a certain thing. It's more than awareness, it gives you some reason why. Then sometimes when that doesn't work, we have to mount an education campaign. Now here I'm using the word education in the way that the pedagogical theorists use it. They tell us that true education means that you have the knowledge of the subject and an emotional comfort level with that knowledge and that subject, that you are in fact able to practice it, to behave accordingly. And that's what I mean here. Obviously here we need both awareness and information evolved, and we need some peer interaction. We need to go right through the diffusion process to make people comfortable enough that they will do something. Unfortunately, those kind of campaigns in toto are often not enough, and sometimes we have to go to reinforcement campaign. It's more than just awareness. We really have to dig deep, targeted at those people that we know share our values, and we have to reinforce that hard so they come out of the woodwork. What did Detroit do when the Japanese automobile threat hit? They ran a campaign which said what? Buy American. A reinforcement campaign. Buy American. We know you share our values. Hey, get on board. Buy American. No reasons were given. They didn't talk about comparative quality or price. They merely said, buy American. Sometimes that won't do it, and we have to mount a far more difficult attitude change campaign. As Drunig and others have shown us, we have the skills, the techniques to do it, but it obviously takes some careful planning and a great knowledge of the science of human nature. Sometimes that won't do it, and sometimes we have to follow Drunig all the way and get into a behavior modification campaign. And we also can do that. The reason I give you this list is to ask this question. When faced with a problem or an opportunity, if we are using some form of process management, do we immediately just put together some messages and start shooting? Or do we say, hey, where does it fall on this scale? What kind of a campaign am I employing here? And what types of activities make sense in that kind of a campaign? I think our time is about up. I was going to tell you about the model of a successful organization. Come next year, maybe I'll be modeling a successful organization.
I
just want to
know where I can get a copy of Val's.
Just write Val's on your business card. Let me see if I can nail all this home to you, though, because I'm very serious when I talk about human nature, that that's what we practice. Let me tell you a little story. True story. I was at Glasgow State University about 2 years ago giving a talk, and just before lunch I went into the restroom to wash my hands, and there on the wall was the best example I have seen yet of what I mean by real down-to-earth, where the rubber meets the road, human nature. Instead of having good old all-American paper towels, they had one of those communistic machines that blows hot air at you, you know. And on this machine is an instruction plaque, and that plaque is the definition of human nature. Here's what the plaque says. It says, 1, shake excess water from hands. 2, push button to operate machine. 3, wipe hands lightly under warm airflow until dry. Well, the practitioner that understood human nature and the process management of public relations had been there before me, and it scratched on 4, wipe hands on hands. You get the point? That's what we do. And we've got to have some science for that very unpredictable outcome. We have to be more scientific than the scientists, because we don't know the outcome. So we've got to apply our science perfectly, and when it's time to wipe hands, boy, we know how. Thank you.
Thank you. My card.